You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where if you're voted out, you're required to make a scene. If you enjoy your trip into the midside here today, please check out our flagship program, Welcome to the Midside. You can find that on themidside.com, iTunes, or wherever podcasts are streamed. How are you doing this week, Survivor fans? Instantly, I get a Facebook update. And this isn't even a Twitter update. And this isn't even like somebody tweeted at me or something. This is just one of those new highlights from Boston Rob, the Monday Morning Podcast, New England Patriots, which actually sums up everything I've been doing today. We've got Survivor, we've got Monday Morning Podcast, Bill Burr, and I'm doing this podcast alone in the style of Bill Burr, and then New England Patriots. They have a bye this week, but I've been watching football all day. So though that notification disrupted this podcast, it sort of was appropriate. I've now put my phone on silent so that will happen again. So let's sort of restart this, and I'll say, what's up, Survivor fans? I'm not too excited about this episode. I'm not too excited about this episode of Survivor. That's why I didn't even bother getting a guest. I didn't even feel like there was that much to talk about with a guest. There was not that much the guest could add to the show. Therefore, I didn't get a guest this week. So I'm just going to be sort of hitting the big issues, talking about what stood out to me, and sort of what there needs to be paid attention to going forward, because this is the episode before the merge. We now know from the previews, because, you know, I saw one during football, that they're going to be merging next week. And traditionally, the episode before the merge isn't very good. It's the same sense in that an episode before a mid-season finale or before a season finale isn't very good. Why? Because the narrative is going down into a valley, and then it'll pick back up again in a peak. The three traditional peaks in Survivor narrative are, of course, the first episode, the merge, or the episode right after the merge, and the finale. That's why people say in the merge you can often figure out who's going to win because they get the biggest story. Although they are merging at 13, so that makes it a little harder because there's so many people to show that the winner candidate might not emerge. Although this year, it will be interesting because we've only got a few winner candidates really left. So it'll be interesting to see how those characters are all edited. I'll get to that in a little bit, though. The first thing I want to talk about is just, you know, my basic reaction to the episode. And Michaela, like, I don't even know why I want to say her name like Beetlejuice. But her reaction when she was voted out. Somebody check me out there, one of you Survivor Rolodex people. You have a Rolodex of the memories of the show, because I used to have that, but there's so much rattling around in my head now that I don't anymore. Has anyone ever reacted after being voted out the way she reacted? And I mean after it was shown. I don't mean when the votes are still being read. I mean, this went on for like 5 minutes. Well, it felt like that. It wasn't really 5 minutes, but that's what I'm saying. Comparatively to all the other people that have ever been voted out in the history of the show, it felt like it was a very long time, the way she was sort of spiraling out of control after being blindsided. And I don't remember that ever happening in the history of Survivor, which is either very revealing of Michaela's character or very revealing of everybody else. And what I mean by that is, you know they're starving, you know they're tired, you know it's a stressful situation. So why don't more people, after being blindsided, break in the way Michaela broke? Because, I mean, on one hand, and this was the thing I was going to be very harsh about, it's sort of like, take it with dignity, take it with class, and just leave. Leave silently. You know, people have said a comment here or there, but even when they say a comment there, here or there, it's like, what are you really accomplishing? But just leave and just be like, all right, they got me, they made a move. and it may be a stupid move, and we'll talk about that in a second, and going forward it may hurt them, but it doesn't concern you anymore. The second that last vote is read and you're dead, you're done, you're dead. You're dead in the game. There's no point in really saying anything anymore. So what is the purpose in saying anything? And that's sort of always been my perspective on it. You know, maybe that's a white perspective. Maybe that's a white privilege perspective. I don't even know why I said that, but you get what I'm saying. I'm sure somebody will spin it to that somehow. You know, maybe it's just because I have so much to go back to and I have such a comfortable life. I mean, if you saw in Michaela's final words, she said, well, I guess I'll get rich some other way. Does somebody want to tell her that winning $1 million on a game show doesn't really get you that rich? First of all, the government takes about half of that as like a winnings tax. So you're really only left, we'll say, generously with $500,000. And then after that, it all depends on what you spend it on, right? What are you going to buy a house? Okay, there's, depending on where you are, that's $100,000 to $300,000 gone right there. You're going to buy a car? Well, how nice is the car going to be? That can be anywhere from, you know, $20,000 to $1 million, depending on how nice of a car you want to buy. So my point is, I guess it's considered rich, but I just don't think that getting that kind of money is going to make you rich in the way she was thinking. And in the same sense that, why are you going on Survivor to get rich? Like, this is your get rich quick scheme. First of all, there's no such thing as a get rich quick scheme. If you do that, you're not going to get the money quickly. Second of all, why go on Survivor to do that? Has anyone who's ever come off of Survivor taken that money and turned it into riches and a fortune? You know, Boston Rob and Amber, they have 2 million, right? Or 1 million after taxes. They're raising 4 daughters. They're living in Florida. He's playing pro poker. Pro poker, that takes money to invest into because you have to pay to get into the tournaments. So they must have done something decent with the money, although I don't know what they're doing for work. I don't know what any of these people are doing for work. And they also had their money from being on The Amazing Race, their show appearances. They had their show Against the Odds, which was them moving to Vegas to see him try and become a pro poker player before they had their kids. So they have money from a lot of other endeavors as well. But any winner, can anyone out there, again, the people out there with the Rolodex memories, I'm going to call them the Rolodex fans from now on, the Rolodex fans out there, is there anyone out there who can think of a Survivor winner who has taken their money and turned it into a fortune? The only one I can possibly think of, and I don't know what's going on with him, I don't even remember his post-game interview, I just remember what I was told. I remember that Brian Hydeck, after he went on, this was still back in the day when they were doing the morning shows, when they had to go on the morning show to get their check, because this is way back in Survivor 5, Survivor Thailand. Spoilers for anyone who's watching the show in reverse. I remember my godmother still watched the show at that point, and we would talk after every episode, and you know, we talked afterwards, and she told me that when he was on the finale, or not on the finale, on the morning show, and they gave him his check, they asked him what he was going to do with it, and he was like, oh, I'm going to invest it, I'm going to save it, and so on and so forth, and she had the reaction of, okay, you can stop playing now, like, you don't have to, like, give answers that the jury is looking for, like, just take the money and be honest about it. But I do think he was being honest, because I think that's his personality. He'll kind of figure out the most logical way to spend it, the statistically best way to have the money make its own money. So I would think he's the most likely to have become rich off of the show or created some sort of fortune and have the money build on itself exponentially. But I don't think that anyone ever has. I mean, maybe Richard Hatch did decently because he evaded taxes all that time. I mean, which I don't avoid him, or I don't blame him for. Like, kudos to him if he could get away with it. Oh, no. Oh, no. Is Richard Hatch the Donald Trump of Survivor? No, because there's no women that he would grab by the... Although, I wonder if there would be the same outrage if someone like Richard Hatch came out and said, yeah, grab him by the cock. Do you think people would get as upset about that if a gay guy came out and said that, or if any guy came out and said that about another man? Or is it just worse when you say that sort of thing about a woman? It's a side note. This is where my mind goes, ladies and gentlemen. So it sort of shows you Michaela's perspective on the whole entire game. My cat chiming in there. And again, Those are what we call the podcasts. They love to, even during the main show, talk up and speak up like that. Because whenever I start doing things, they immediately want attention. I don't know, whatever. Yeah, it shows Michaela's perspective on the game and on the show, that she was doing it to get rich. She wasn't doing it to, you know, play the game. She wasn't doing it even almost, it didn't seem like she was doing it to be on TV. Maybe she didn't want to be that revealing, but I don't know. She seemed pretty much like what she was what she was. Like, that was what I really appreciated about her. Like, what she was what she was. That was the way it is. And she seemed to be that way and not sort of like a classless, ignorant way, which stereotypically you get with a lot of minorities. Oh, no. Said something unpolitically correct. You know, she seemed to, her and Cece this season, both seemed to be more educated than the typical, stereotypical black person we see on television or in reality shows. You know, if you ever watched, the Flavor of Love series, you'll know what I'm talking about. I mean, fuck, even any sort of MTV reality show, right? You talk about classless and ignorant. That doesn't even have to do with race or gender. Fucking, if you've ever watched Are You the One? Like, everyone on that show is ignorant. I can't get enough of it. I watch every episode. I binge-watched every episode when I found out this show existed. And I watched the first episode. I was like, wow, that production concept's brilliant. I watched every episode. But they're still completely ignorant people. And Michaela didn't seem to be that way. And now I sort of have to question if it's her edit. Because to react like that after you got blindsided, yeah, obviously you're not going to agree. You don't think it's the right thing to get to blindside yourself. Although I would say that if you can have that level of consciousness about your game, awareness, I would say that's a higher level of gameplay. If you can say, well, the right move for this tribe is probably to vote me out and blindside me, then I think you're able to see the game on another level. And I think that's the level you need to see the game on if you're playing. You'll be able to look at each person and say, what's the best move from their perspective? And then add them all up and say, oh, okay, well, all of them, the best move is to vote me out, therefore they should blindside me, and then say, okay, how am I going to play this and continue to play this? What have I done previously to lay the groundwork so I don't get blindsided? And what am I going to do right now to reinforce that so I don't get blindsided? That's the sort of level of gameplay you need to be at. But she clearly wasn't at that. She clearly was sort of playing off the cuff, playing vote to vote, which, I mean, we saw from the beginning where I said, you know, if she hates Figgy that much, why did she vote for her? And in the same sense, last week, last episode, she said, you know, you guys have the majority on that tribe, the millennials. If you can't figure out how to stay together, you deserve to lose. And then this week, after she finds out Figgy's been voted out, she says, you know, it was about time. It was time for her to go. She'd been in the game too long. So how, on one hand, can you say, you know, stay together, don't vote the millennials out, and on the other hand say her time in the game was up, it was time for her to go, she was sick of her? Like, you have to be consistent. Even if there are things you think internally, you have to be consistent with the way you're saying things externally. And when you portray yourself in that way, where you're being two different ways, well, that's where the lack of trust comes in, because people know that you're not really saying, that's so weird, because again, she seemed like she was very off the cuff and straightforward, but she didn't, you know, she was contradicting herself all the time. And that's the thing about a player like that, is I do think she was straightforward. I think it was very emotional gameplay. And someone like that is not someone you want in the game. You want to take out as many of the unpredictable factors as possible. You don't know what they're going to do. Compounding that is the fact that she was proving to be a force in challenges. You don't want a force in challenges who is unpredictable in the game. You don't. If you have a force in challenges who is your number one ally, take them to the end. Have them be your shield. That can only help you. That's a sure number for you. But if they're unpredictable and they can flip on a dime, which is becoming the common gameplay, and we're going to talk about that. I'm going to talk about that in 1 second here. Then you need to get rid of them. And then that's exactly what I was just going to lead into. I'm transitioning in my mind here already. Perfect transition into the millennials. So 4 of the first 5 people voted out, I believe, were Gen Xers. We had Rachel, the Playboy Asian, Paul, Cece, and Lucy were the first four voted out. Then we had Mari was the second voted out. So that gives the millennials a three-person lead. Three-person. That is incredible going into the expansion. As a the David Healy told me, that's what the term actually is expansion. It's not swap. It's not, I guess you can call it twist, but it's a type of twist. It's the expansion. The expansion sounds like something you go and you have to buy. It's a download downloaded content, DLC. Oh, let's download the expansion. Remember when they tried to do the Survivor video game? That was fucking shitty. Now, I sound like I'm high right now, but I'm not. I'm straight edge. I don't even do anything. So, yeah, you know, going into the expansion, the millennials had a three-person lead. Three-person. That is a lead that it's impossible to overcome at the merge if you can keep the tribe together. Right now, at a merge of 13, that would mean that you would have three more people than the other people, so half and half would be, well, 7-6 like they have right now. That's a two-person advantage. So we're talking a, I can't even do math. Well, this is how fucking retarded I am. So 7-6, they would need one more, would be 8-5. So yeah, that would be an 8-5 advantage right there. Like, do you know how hard that is to overcome? And that's literally, I'm not even going to explain the math I did because I don't even know how I did it at this point. I just know 8 plus 5 is 13, and that's a 3-person advantage, so we're just going to go from there. Sound like a total idiot, but I fucking hate math. Yeah, that's like a nearly impossible odds to overcome, 8-5 at the merge. And that's going into the merge. That's if things had stayed a 3-person advantage, which, if you have that much of an advantage, going into the expansion, you can vote off even more Gen Xers. That way, you have an even greater advantage going into the merge of your original tribes versus their original tribe. So on one hand, it seems absolutely fucking retarded. Oh no, I said retarded like it means stupid. It's absolutely fucking retarded, it seems like, to vote out people from your own original tribe. On the other hand, isn't it sort of inevitable to have that much of an advantage going into the merge or going into the expansion and not vote out members of your own tribe? You have a 3-person advantage. It's very easy for everyone to sit there and go, oh, we have a huge advantage. Why don't I get rid of this person who's a big threat to me? And they did that, and they still have a 1-person advantage. The millennials are still up 7-6. So that logic holds. There is a problem here, though, with the way I see it, is this whole voting block nonsense that Jeff Probst is talking about as if it's this new style of gameplay. So this voting block nonsense, this actually began in Amazon, if you recall. Haha, Rolodex fans, I got one on you here. It began in Amazon with Rob Cesternino. This was the strategy that he used. Every week post-merge, he took the people who were at the apparent bottom and allied with them to vote out the person who was at the apparent top. He did voting blocks. He wasn't loyal to any person. Of course, that's why he lost the game. And same thing, Johnny Fairplay did the same thing post-merge. He took Rob Cesternino's strategy and basically injected steroids into it and did it again. And then again, he lost. Now, why did he lose? If you take loyalty out of the game, two things will happen to you. As it gets closer and closer to the end, when there are fewer people to move around the numbers with and play these voting blocks with, the harder it will be for you to get ahead because there's no one who's loyal to you. They've developed more loyalty to other people. So when push comes to shove, they're going to vote with the other people. Or when push comes to shove, if they don't have loyalty to anyone, they're just going to crunch the numbers. We saw this happen famously at the final tribal council in Amazon. Well, the second to final, where Matt voted out Rob because he didn't have any loyalty to him, even though Rob taught him a lot about the game and brought him that far. And of course, Matt then lost the final vote. This is, of course, the converse of the strategy of being loyal to people. The difficulty with being loyal to people is earlier in the game. you have to build the alliances earlier in the game and keep them together through the middle part. That's where the difficulty comes in. The difficulty there then transitions into a slighter ease at the end point of the game. And for me, I would much rather have it be easier at the end of the game than harder at the end of the game. Why would you want to increase your difficulty level each month? Essentially, with the voting block strategy, with the Rob Cesternino strategy, you're increasing your difficulty a little bit every time, every vote, because you're voting out another person that you could flip-flop with. And with the fewer numbers, it's harder to flip-flop around, so loyalty becomes more important. The later in the game there is the more loyalty becomes important. This is why we saw when Boston Rob got to the end in Redemption Island, it seemed like he was playing with a bunch of zombies or knuckleheads because he had created a strong sense of loyalty among his tribe. That's why Ometepe is one of the best tribes ever. The same sense of, that's why the ending of Palau is so interesting because of the amount of loyalty in that alliance. That alliance of some of the five best players ever, and when you got down to Ian, Katie, and Tom, and to see what happened between Ian and Katie, you know, they had such a bond that the ending was pretty tense because of that sense of loyalty. So I'm not saying there aren't difficulties either way. I mean, there obviously are difficulties. That's why this game is so interesting. But when you take the loyalty out, it does get even harder. Because Ian, even though he lost his connection to Katie, still could have gone to the end with Tom. In the same sense, even though Katie lost her connection with Ian, she still went to the end with Tom. And Tom still, you know, he only voted out Ian because Ian wanted him to. In the same sense with Rob, the reason Rob was able to do what he did, besides the fact that he had the hidden immunity idol that allowed him to nullify Andrea coming back, because if Andrea lied with the two girls, he would have just played his idol. The loyalty kept him in the game. I mean, Philip was loyal to him. Natalie was loyal to him, and that's why he was able to get to the end. Grant was loyal to him. They were all loyal to him because he wasn't playing voting blocks. But now we seem to see the millennials, and this seems to be a stereotypically millennial thing, doesn't it? Voting blocks. We see them seemingly playing the voting blocks, or at least Probst is trying to plant the seed in their head. I always wonder, this is one of the most fascinating things to me about the show, is does Probst plant these things in his head, in their heads? Or does he see what's going on from all the dailies? I'm assuming they get dailies. So for those of you out there who don't know, when you are directing a movie, when you're producing a movie, when you're editing a movie, either a mainstream, a big budget movie, you get dailies. Dailies are the footage that was shot that day, compiled together and given to you so you can see the material you have. This helps you do two things. It helps you, from a production standpoint, it helps you be confident in what you've already done, and it also helps you make any adjustments in the shooting schedule. So if there are things you didn't like that happened, or the things you know you need now, you can make that adjustment after seeing what's going on with what you already shot. This is obviously a lot easier when you have big budget productions and you have more money to play around with. You can set aside money at the beginning and say, these are for reshoots, or this is for, you know, anything that may come up while we're shooting. I mean, obviously this happens with the huge movies where they've got $250 million budgets, because you can put aside a portion of the budget to do that. That clearly doesn't happen with smaller budgets. You don't really, one, you don't have time to look at the dailies because you're doing 80 things yourself, and two, you don't have the money to make that many adjustments. You kind of just have to stick with what you have and go with it and hope it works out and trust your artistic vision. But with a show like Survivor, where Jeff Probst has so much influence on it, I don't know if he can watch all the dailies, because, I mean, every camera, 36 days for 24 hours a day, that's a lot of footage to watch. But he can watch the key things to know what's going on, to know the buttons to push on these people. And I'm sure there are people who watch things and report back to Probst. What are the, again, Rolodex fans, what are the contract obligations for people who work on the show from a production standpoint? And what I mean by that is, it's supposed to be conventionally, and we saw this with Donald Trump, where people said, oh, there's crazy stuff in The Apprentice that he said, but can't be released unless somebody wants to pay the $5 million fee for breaking their silence in their contract. What is that for Survivor? If you're an editor for Survivor, if you're a producer for Survivor, if you're a cameraman for Survivor, what's your confidentiality agreement? And why have none of us ever interviewed these people? Wouldn't that be interesting from our standpoint? Maybe I'll get one of them on here. I don't know. Somebody, one of the Rolodex fans out there, figure out what are the confidentiality, the binding agreements for these people. Because just from the standpoint of looking what's going on behind the scenes, you know, we've seen some interviews with people who have been very revealing about what's going on the show, contestants about what's going on behind the show. I can't remember the contestant's name right now, but I remember that Mario Lanza did a review. Mario, who was on my first episode, did an interview with the angry guy who was the angry guy, the old white guy who they seemed to be make out to be angry and was Sugar's rival in Gabon. And, you know, they brought him back for Heroes versus Villains. I can't fucking remember his name for that. I want to say Rudy, but his name's not Rudy at all. That's so fucking, that's racist. That's racist on my part. Oh, they're old and white. They must have the same name. See, you can be racist against white people. White people can be racist against white people. They tried to make him out to be a certain way, but I remember when he talked about one of the challenges, it was sort of like the Frisbee golf challenge where they had to keep shooting the ball and moving it forward to get it to a target. You know, he talked to Mario about how edited that challenge was and doing reshoots in the challenge and things like that. It's very revealing of the production of the show. And, you know, kind of see the way that shapes things. Honestly, I don't even remember how I got here from what I was talking about. So I was talking about the, oh yeah, Jeff Probst shaping the show with the whole voting block thing. Yeah. Who knows? I mean, it'd be really interesting to me to figure out because, you know, we're going into the merge and we're going to see, are they still going to do voting blocks or are they not? Because there's a lot to look at here from a story perspective about what's going to happen. You know, commonly you can look at the sort of strategy of the show and the logic of that and figure out who's going to stay and who's going to go and combine that with the, you know, your knowledge of the basic editing trends to come up with a winner's pick. But I often say that you can't predict the strategy, so it's important to just say, because you never know what's going to happen, right? Did anyone think that Boston Rob would blindside Matt twice? No, like there's stuff you can't predict. It's crazy shit happens sometimes. Like, would anyone have been able to predict that Katie would get purpled rocked in Blood versus Water, and that's ultimately the tribal council that led to Tyson's win? No, you wouldn't have, but once Vetus and Aris were voted out, it was clear Tyson had the winner's edit because of all this the stuff about, you know, his girlfriend and winning for her, and they showed an emotional side of him they never showed before. So while a purple rock, well, you can't predict that. If you just stuck with the edit and say, I don't know how he's going to win, but he's going to win, you can just be confident in your pick that way and just enjoy the ride. So in the same sense here, it's hard to know what's going to happen yet. There are so many cross-generational, cross-tribe alliances that strategically it's hard to predict what's going to happen. But we can, again, look at the major characters. And some of the major characters disappeared in this episode, which is why, again, it wasn't a great episode. This episode, I think, was edited a certain way for a reason. I won't say what that reason is. I will say that if you go back and listen to the last episode about what Tim was saying, you can figure out what I think that reason is. But a lot of characters got put on the back burner. We didn't see much of Chris. We didn't see much of David. We didn't see much of Ken. I can't remember any of these characters, but these are all the big characters for the season. We saw a little bit of Zeke, which, again, helps his edit. He's hard to see Zeke not winning. He's got a big edit, but then again, I've said over and over again, he could be the tie for this season. You know, they built the edit around him, even though he doesn't ultimately win. It was his season. This is likely going to be Zeke's season, whether he wins or not, just the way this has been edited. The person we got a lot of this week, and it was a big week for him from a, you know, story winner's perspective, because he has his closing montage. I always look for those moments, like, oh, what are the moments that could go in the closing montage at the reunion show? He has this closing montage moment is Jay was the one who was shown changing the entire vote. And this is likely a time when reality lines up with the editing, where Jay likely did influence the vote, and he was the one who changed it. And then, you know, his response at Tribal when Michaela came after him was like, is it you? He's like, yeah, it was me. That's a big moment for him. This was a big episode for him. This could be a turning point in his edit. And his edit has been slowly building. He was, interestingly, here's the interesting thing about his edit overall, going back to the first episode. In the first episode, they tried to want to sort of build a four between Michelle, Jay, Taylor, and Figgy in the edit, and they called it the Triforce, with only the three of them minus Michelle. But even among that Triforce, Jay was edited differently. And it seemed like it was because Taylor and Figgy were a couple, but it was really because they were setting up Taylor and Figgy as the reason the Millennials didn't stay together post-expansion. You know, Figgy is the one who bore the brunt of that attack. You know, the whole Mari vote came back to haunt her when Adam flipped and voted her out. That was directly related in the edit, in the story. In the same sense, they distanced Jay from that. And the fact that he was expanded onto a different tribe from Figgy and Taylor meant they could expand him away from that. So his edit is very positive, and he has a very possible winner's edit, and it could go that way. It's just difficult, though, to see him aligning with people like Zeke and Adam. And it's very easy to see Zeke and Adam getting together again post-merge and going with Chris and David and Ken and Jessica. To me, that would be the most likely. I actually, even though I think Jay has a good edit, I at the same time would not be surprised to see him go right at the merge as a young athletic guy. Although Taylor is also a major candidate for going right at the merge as well. So either of those, that's part of what's saving Jay right now, is keeping Taylor around. I mean, this is the Jeremy strategy from his second season, right? Keep the stronger people around so they're more likely to get picked off before you. Jay may survive because Taylor becomes the target at the merge, and then other people are already aligned with him, and they stick with him, and he gets to the end that way. So it'll be interesting to see what happens in the merge, but just to remind you guys to sort of sum up this episode and this sort of discussion on the show this week, the big characters to watch are Chris, David, and Ken from the Gen Xers tribe, and I think Jessica is in there a little bit. I don't think she has a chance of winning, but you know, she was always present from the beginning, and then her episode got a little bigger. Her edit got a little bigger when, you know, she helped vote out Paul, and then the whole confrontation with Lucy, although that kind of transferred her edit to Ken and David. You know, that's the other person. I don't know if I mentioned David. So again, Chris, Ken, David. I think I did. And then from the Millennials side, the characters to watch are Adam, but it's hard to know if his was just because of the Hidden Immunity Idol, his good edit. Jay and Zeke. Those are the three who have the great edits off of those tribe. I would put privileges on, overall, I would say Ken, Zeke, and Jay are sort of the top three to watch out for here, editing-wise, story-wise. Although I will say strategy, the person who I think is going to fuck everything up and is going to make everything confusing is Hannah. I think she's in over her head, and I think she is just going to confuse matters when she confuses herself and thinks emotionally and can't see past herself. You know, I opened this episode talking about if you can see Survivor on that higher level where you see how you relate to everyone and everyone else's plans and how that relate to you, then you can really see the game the way you need to see it in order to make the moves you need to make. Hannah is the complete opposite of that perspective. She is completely in her own head, and she can't see outside of herself. And ultimately, I think that's going to cause a lot of chaos post-merge as the original tribe lines and the alliance lines get blurred. I think that she will find herself confused, and they may get a lot of narrative. It could be good. They could get a lot of narrative weight out of that, but I think it will. I think her specifically, she will make a lot of the strategy interesting. All right. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for listening this week. If you have anyone you want to hear on the show, if you have any topics you want to talk about, you want me to talk about, you want us to talk about, just, you know, leave a comment if you see it on a thread in a group. You can shoot me a message on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on Instagram. You can find me on Snapchat. All of those are the Midside. That's where you can find any information about the show. And as I said, if you enjoy the show here, please check out our flagship show, Welcome to the Midside. You can find that on themidside.com. You can subscribe on iTunes, and you can find it anywhere podcasts are streaming. This concludes your journey into the Midside. I'm Justin Embleznesky reminding you that if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Have a day.